Hey, this is Weird from the Gun Blog Variety Cast, reminding you that this podcast is a member of the Self Defense Radio Network. Check out all the other great podcasts at selfdefenseradio.net.
Hello and welcome to the Handgun World Podcast. My name is Carl Wren from KR Training in Central Texas. Earlier this year, Bob took a few classes from me and offered me the opportunity to be a guest host on the podcast during his break. Like Bob, I'm a practical guy. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. I've been a firearms instructor for the past 26 years. I have my own training facility about 1 hour from Austin, Texas. My team and I each teach classes about 35 weeks a year, and I host national trainers like Tom Givens, Ben Steger, Masad Ayoub, and Craig Douglas every year. I've taken about 2,200 hours of classes from more than 50 different trainers over the past 30 years, and I'm a grandmaster in four of USPSA's eight divisions. Today's podcast is about force-on-force training. I've been involved with force-on-force training since the early 90s, played paintball, then got involved with force-on-force training through Insights Training with Greg Hamilton and John Holshin, who I'm interviewing today. Also Marty Hayes with the Firearms Academy of Seattle. And then I took my simunition instructor training from Ken Murray, who was one of the inventors of simunition and author of probably the best book on the topic, which is called Training at the Speed of Life. Today I'm going to talk to John Holshin about his experiences teaching force-on-force training and the value of it to the average carry permit holder. Welcome, John, to the Handgun World Podcast. Why don't you start by giving us your history and training and your background?
Right. Well, I started in martial arts as a kid, basically, in high school. And early on, I had instructors that demonstrated and talked about self-defense and training otherwise. So that kind of started me on the path of, you know, when we look at priority survival, the aspects of mental conditioning and tactics as being important aspects of it. I had a career in the military, special operations, military intelligence, and as a non-commissioned officer, you do a lot of training. As a special forces soldier, part of my career for many years, so it was pretty natural for me to move into providing training for civilians, private citizens as well. Something that people forget, you know, I get into these discussions sometimes about, you know, should your instructor have a law enforcement background, a military background, or none of the above, and you know, why both of those can be problematic. You know, I tell people that remember that what really matters is, are these people studying and looking at it from the point of view that you as the consumer need? And yeah, I was a soldier, but I was a husband and a dad and spent a lot of time being interested in the safety and security of my family and myself, like everybody else.
Excellent. You want to talk about Insights Training and what you're doing now?
Yeah. Well, I got involved with Insights Training in the early 90s. It'd been in existence for a couple of years. Met Greg Hamilton, actually, in a military training event. My commanding officer brought Greg in to work on our concealed carry skills. And Greg and I hit it off, found that we really enjoyed working together because we have a very similar approach to tactics training, preparation, and began merging. Greg at the time had more of a background on the shooting side. I had more of a background on the unarmed side, but we both had done some of each. I had shot USPSA, actually IPSC is what we talked about at the time. And so neither one of us were strangers to the other discipline, but we really found that we could merge our skills and the result would be, you know, the sum is greater than the parts. So I went from there, you know, taught for a number of different companies. I'm a frequent guest instructor with Insights these days, as well as I have my own security consulting business in which I do a lot of training, mostly for corporate, military, and government folks through that.
Awesome. And you have an indoor range now as well?
I do. I also own West Coast Armory North in Everett, Washington. We are an indoor range and pro shop. Oh, we've got about 4,000 square feet of space in retail, good selection of firearms, ammunition, all the usual stuff. as well as a three-bay range. Bays are relatively small, 6 lanes each, but so that gives us 18 lanes to work with in 3 separate bays. We're actually in the process, as we speak, of building out our 4th bay. The public aspect of shooting has grown so much that we had either had to make a choice between running classes or having long waits in the on the public side. So we're expanding into a 4th bay.
That's wonderful. The one thing that I point out to people, and I think it's to a certain degree not appreciated and not remembered enough in the training community today, is how much Insights did in pioneering the idea of running everything all together as one training program. I've been doing all this studying, developing this 2-day historical handgun class, studying the history of handgun training. And really, before the 90s, before Insights and before Tactical Defense Institute, nobody else really combined unarmed and force-on-force and shooting and medical and tactics and all of the pieces together into sort of a holistic system. That was one of the things that impressed me when I first started training with you guys, was the consistency of the techniques and how everything fit together, and you viewed it as not compartmentalized, which, you know, in police training, certainly in that era, it was still broken up. The defensive tactics people were in one room and the firearms people were in a different room, and often the curriculum would never intersect.
You're absolutely right.
And I think you guys don't necessarily get enough credit for that or enough recognition for it. A lot of the things that you did laid the groundwork for a lot of other things that came later.
Okay. In 1994 and 95, we were working on this, the idea that you need to be able to move fluidly and fluently up and down that use of force continuum. So I don't believe in reinventing the wheel. I went out and went to every conference, every training conference I could find out what other people were doing. And at that time, I had far more questions than I had answers. But the first step, the way I was taught, the first step to solving any problem is defining it accurately. So you've got to get the questions out there first. So I traveled and said, hey, this is what we're thinking about. This is what we've come up with so far. What are you guys doing? What else have you seen that's doing this? And I got nothing but blank looks. I literally had one man that talked about having trained 20-something years before with a former OSS guy from World War II that he said had similar ideas, and he hadn't seen anything like it in over 15 years. So in a way, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, but at the same time, this was an area that had certainly been neglected. I had a lot of law enforcement trainers, police academies that showed a lot of interest, and I did some consulting with them at that point to begin to bring together the firearms instruction and the defensive tactics instruction. And just as you said, they were polar opposites in many cases.
The topic today is force-on-force training, and the reason I have you on is because Insights was one of the schools that really did a lot of it in the 90s in particular, have a lot of experience with it. Certainly you and Greg inspired me to get into force-on-force training and to do a lot of it in my own program, and I learned a lot about how to run it from training with you guys. And so that's why I wanted to have you on to talk about it and answer kind of some basic questions, because there's a lot of live fire training going on right now in the training industry and very little force on force training. And that
absolutely
puzzles, confuses, and saddens me. So I thought maybe if we talk about it, that'll get more people interested in it again. So I'm just going to start with the top one, which is, you know, explain to the people, what is force on force training? What does that mean?
Well, I think most people, when they think of force-on-force training, if they've been exposed to it at all, what comes to mind is what I would call scenario-based training. So you've got a situation, and this is why I suspect that Greg and I, you know, came into this so early, is again, from the military, we learned that if you cannot perform the skill on demand in context, you really don't have anything. And we talk about on command versus on demand. An example, I taught in the Special Forces Medic course for a while. And if I say, okay, show me how you put a tourniquet on. Okay, that's a certain level of skill. Now, if I bring a live animal role model in that has a severe bleeder, and I've taught you how to use a tourniquet, I've taught you how to use a pressure dressing, I've taught you how to pack a wound, I've taught you how to do direct pressure, and you got to look at this wound and decide which of these treatment modalities as appropriate, and then executed in a timely fashion. And that's not just because you have the skills doesn't mean that you are able to do that well if you have not trained at it, if you haven't practiced at it. So for us, the idea of the culmination of all training needs to be situational training exercises, both for learning and for testing.
So a typical force-on-force scenario that you would run in an armed citizen class, can you give a little more detail if you're going to prep somebody and say, here, if you come to class, here's what you're going to do?
Well, it's interesting, and this is one of those things that there's two answers. There's the real answer, and there's the answer that people find easier to understand. The real answer is that in most cases, the actual situation is relatively insignificant. Now, people don't want to hear that. They're like, oh, no, I need the story. And, you know, Skip Gokenauer, our friend from the National Tactical Invitational, he calls it the bedtime story. And the point is, it can be one of various fairy tales, whether you're dealing with trolls or whether you're dealing with, whatever the nature of the threat is. We have to do the same things. We need to manage certain types of interactions. So what I typically start with is I'll put people, I say, you're in basically a convenience store. Maybe you bought gas, but pay at the pump was broken and you had to go in to pay. And things happen. You could be there when a robbery happens. You could be there. And we do things like demonstrate different types of robbery so that people gather information, because, you know, in a way, we need to talk about what we're trying to accomplish here before we can understand why the scenarios are what they are. And what we're trying to accomplish is we're trying to give you the ability to learn about and practice your skills in three different areas. The first area is interpersonal communication. What can you learn by observing this person? What does he want to communicate to you? And how's he behaving in his body posture and his verbalizations? What can you learn by observing him concerning how he's moving, what his capabilities and intentions may be? And of course, realizing that's a two-way street, what do you want to communicate to him? In many cases early on, what people are saying verbally and what their body language are doing are completely at odds. So we need to learn to manage that interpersonal communication. So we need to experience that interpersonal communication. The second aspect that we're focusing on is managing your environment. Space, time, distance, obstacles, cover. This whole area of individual tactics, movement, of course, is paramount. Again, this is not practiced hardly at all in live fire, and frankly, it's usually practiced incorrectly in live fire. So, or suboptimally, shall we say, in terms of suboptimal tactics. So that's the next piece that we're trying to do. The third and last piece is managing and using your equipment. So actually getting good hits, getting an effective draw stroke, getting good hits while maximizing use of cover, movement, et cetera, possibly reloads, possibly malfunctions. And it's only that very last piece that you can really practice in other, or can learn much about in other than scenario-based training. So again, I might start off in the convenience store, and things are going to happen. A guy may come in and rob the place, and it may be all quiet and such that people don't even realize a robbery has happened, because the guy came up, like most bank robberies, and gave the teller a note or whispered to, in this case, the attendant, the cashier, and said, hey, fill that bag full of money or I'll kill you. I got a gun in my pocket. He gets his money. He walks out. Or the guy may walk in and start yelling and screaming. Interpersonal interactions, you may observe various types of assaults that may or may not involve you directly, and how do you react to them? What can you learn about the capabilities of both the aggressor and the defender by observing those type of situations? But really, where the situation happens is relatively insignificant. The bedtime story, I give enough to satisfy people, but the reality of it is, it could be any setting that you would deal with in your life and in commonly going throughout your life.
One of the things that that I've done, and I've changed the way I've done it over the years, but as the students get more experience in the scenarios, I'll start using some of them as bad guys, because what I found is when they have to walk into the convenience store and rob it, it changes their perspective. And
Absolutely.
I think it helps them recognize those behaviors if they've done it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is very valuable. The other, I do that a little earlier than many instructors do, because being the bad guy, you know, if I talk about, for example, there's, you know, I hate to give away all my secrets here talking about it. If people come to class, you know, they're going to have heard about things if they've listened to this, but that's all right. We're trying to educate. For example, in many cases, I would rather remove myself from the situation would be my first course of action than employ deadly force. And we've had many cases, one particular venue we use, which basically simulates a convenience store very well, is there's a hallway that you can predict probably goes to the restrooms and the storeroom and the office. And even if you've never been down there, it at least takes you out of sight. And the bad guy, he's looking around this room that has maybe five people in it, a clerk and four customers. And I tell people, you know, when he turns to look and address somebody else, well, he's not looking at you. That's your time to do something, whether it's draw and engage, whether it's move or whatever. And until you play that bad guy, and it's really funny seeing the frustration on the bad guy's face, he scans from left to right, and let's say the hallway's over on the right, and as he scans, there's five people in the room, and as he comes back, there's only four people in the room, and he scans again and comes back, and there's only three people in the room. And about that time, they're like, what the heck? Where'd the people go? And they don't know. Did you duck down behind the store display, or did you leave the room? And bottom line, what I'm getting at here is playing the bad guy also gives you an increased confidence in your techniques and tactics. And maybe they're going to stand and draw for whatever reason. And again, the guy, you know, glances to look at another person, and by the time he looks back, he's already getting shot. And you playing that as the bad guy, you're like, holy moly, I never saw the draw stroke. How did that happen? And if you just tell people this, they, you know, they may believe it to a certain degree, but experiencing it as the bad guy is much more powerful in giving them confidence in how these techniques work and don't work.
So that kind of leads to one of the other questions I had, which is, you know, how much training does somebody need before they do force on force training? Can, like in Texas, we have a 5-hour carry permit class, and they haven't learned how to draw from a holster, but they do know how to shoot, and they've gotten 4 hours of lecture on when and when you can or could, or maybe you could shoot under the law and some instruction, basic concept tactics. Is somebody at that level, are they ready for force on force? Would they benefit from it?
Well, what I look at is, again, I go back to prior to survival, which will state for anybody unfamiliar. I use the term mental conditioning. Some people use mindset as the first. To me, mindset is a subset of mental conditioning, but that's another discussion. I use mental conditioning as your first priority. Your second priority is tactics. Your third is skill. Skill is your skill in arms. The first, that mental conditioning, well, that's awareness. That's communication skills. That is your mindset. The second, tactics, well, that is managing space, time, and distance again. What I would say is you have to have a certain amount of ability and exposure in each of these areas before you can actually exercise it. If we throw you in, it's like going back to martial arts. I know people that say, oh, you know, we have new students spar, fight on the first night. I'm like, okay, I can kind of see a way you might justify that, but in my opinion, all you can really learn is what they already know at that point. So I like to give them abilities, skills, or I like to give them knowledge and skills in each of those areas before I put them in a situation where I hope they can exercise the knowledge, awareness, abilities, skills that I have given them. So I don't like to just throw people in there. I like to get them, give them some information first and hope that they will then look for opportunities. You know, there's something else we're leaving out here is I actually nowadays, I use an in-between step. To me, this is still force on force training, but it's between live fire and scenario based. And that is, I use interactive drills. So I'll have two people facing each other, for example, and I'll say, hey, just observe this guy go from his gun dangling down to the side to pointing at you and firing a shot. We might use a CERT gun to do this, a laser gun to do this. What does it look like? What if he's turned, you're at the side, and he's going to look at you over his left shoulder and turn and shoot you? What's that look like? What about from the right? What about from different directions? What about reactionary gap? If someone is a distance away from you with a knife and they're going to step forward and stab you, or a club and step forward and strike you, what's it look like? How much time do you actually have? So we do interactive training that are still drills before going into full scenario-based training. So those are still force-on-force drills, but they are specific prescribed drills versus, I'm not going to say scenario-based is freewheeling, but it's again, where the difference is performance on demand and the opportunity to directly observe before you're expected to have, performance on command. Let me start over on that. The difference is performance on command is we're telling you this is the skill you're going to observe and practice, versus later in scenarios it will be performance on demand. As it's required, you will come out with the correct answer. So I like to put those type of drills in before getting into full scenario-based training.
Do you add those into live fire classes, or do you present those in a separate course?
Well, now we get into another one of your questions, and that is force-on-force training popular? And one of my constant frustrations, and you said it in the introduction as well, I can fill dozens of live fire courses a year. It is rare for me to be able to fill two tactics courses a year. People just do not understand. They don't know what they don't know. I think there's two issues that come into play. One is that it's difficult for them to understand what they're going to learn in advance until they have experienced that they don't understand what they can learn, so they don't seek that training out. Secondly, I think is ego. Many folks, you know, they have an attitude of, hey, you know, I've been alive X number of years. I've been out here, you know, on my own. Maybe I've traveled. Maybe I've gone to foreign countries. I've dealt with bad people. I know how to do this stuff. I'm a pretty capable person. Well, you know, I really want to sit through a class talking about how to do those things. Yeah, I don't think I need that. So the combination is that people don't sign up for classes that are not live fire with nearly the frequency that they sign up for live fire classes. So it's a constant struggle. I've tried different things. I've tried integrating it in a way, kind of, you know, not bait and switch. I'm going to give you what I said I'm going to give you, but hope to suck you in basically through your interest in live fire and expose you to enough of this other to help you understand that there are things that you can learn there, so that you might be more likely to come back and take, you know, our street and vehicle tactics classes is a 3-day course with no live fire whatsoever. No live fire. Now we use a fair amount of simulations or airsoft and, you know, other type of things. And many people, they just don't get that. They're like, well, how can you possibly fill 3 days of useful material for me when I'm not shooting?
That's your street and vehicle class is actually the class, if I go back through my training records, that course and Craig Douglas's ECQC are the two courses I have taken multiple times and learned something every time I go through them. Those two courses, and they're both force on force. Craig's
exactly.
ECQC class has a tiny amount of live fire, but the majority of the learning is all working with other opponents. And so that's something I learned. We've started weaving a lot of red gun work into the live fire classes. We don't get out the simunition guns and all the safety gear because it takes too long.
Right.
But sure, we do a lot of work like you're doing, demonstrating concepts with the red guns.
Mm-hmm. So
absolutely. Cover. Here, stand behind this piece of cover. Mm-hmm. You stand 5 yards downrange. You know, tell the person behind cover what can they see, that sort of thing, which seems
absolutely
to motivate people a little better. And that's kind of been my approach. The other thing that I'm going to do next year is we're going to start a master certificate program where if you take essentially 32 hours of training, and it will include required 4 hours of force on force to get that 32-hour certificate, and then my advanced certificate, which is going to bundle together some other classes, is actually going to have 8 more hours of force on force. In terms of,
excellent,
you have to finish 32 hours to get the basic block, which is supposed to be sort of like the old Gunsight class, you know, the old Gunsight 4-day class, or the old Thunder Ranch 4-day class, or Saad Ayyub's, Mag 40 with all that material. And I'm hoping maybe bundling things together to give the idea that, you know, your training's not complete until you've got all these pieces. And so we'll see how that goes and if people respond to it. Let me switch gears a little bit. From your perspective as somebody who has led a training team and grown instructors through the Insights program and other areas, you know, if somebody is your average state-level carry permit NRA instructor or live fire instructor, what do they need to do if they want to start offering even just red gun-based training? What do they need to go learn to be able to learn how to do that? Because there's not really many programs out there teaching people how to do that.
To be a effective instructor in any topic, in my opinion, you need to have been a diligent student of that topic. And this is where it really falls apart, is that the vast majority of people teaching have never had effective training in interpersonal communication for self-defense. They have not had effective training in individual tactics, managing space, time, and distance. It's like anything else. You've got to start by learning the material yourself. And I'm a believer that in any topic, you don't make an instructor in a instructor course, whether that course is several days long or several weeks long. It takes much more time than that to produce an instructor at anything other than the absolutely most basic level on any topic that we can imagine. Certainly a topic that involves life or death. Do I want to learn how to parachute from a guy that took a 2-day class on how to parachute? No, I don't think so. So the point is there's no shortcuts. People need to develop the skills that we've just been talking about, truly spend time studying them, contemplating them, increasing their knowledge, testing what they believe they know, getting in actual training events, putting themselves in these scenarios to see how this stuff actually works. It's amazing. A related field, I've been in a conversation. I also did a lot of survival training and some survival instruction in my military career. And there's a device called a solar still, and it's in every survival manual that I've ever seen. And the fact of the matter is they barely work under the very best of conditions. And you have all these instructors keep talking about solar stills, and you say, have you ever built one? And I've built one. Okay. Did you actually operate it? And what was your actual outcome? What did you produce? How much water? And the fact of the matter is they're really not a great idea. But there are so many instructors. We've got the same thing going on. I hate to say it, but the NRA has made great strides. But some of the very best instructors I know are NRA instructors, and some of the very worst instructors I know are NRA instructors. The point is the NRA does not have an effective instructor training program, in my opinion. So, guys, if you want to be an instructor in this stuff, and gals, get out there and study it. Get out there and learn it. Travel. Study with Carl, study with me, study with Greg Douglas, study with people that have spent years working on this material. And don't, another common error is, well, I'll just take the best of all of them. Well, Carl, you mentioned this earlier, it's got to be a system. It has to fit together. Otherwise, it will be very difficult to learn and even harder to employ under stress. So get out there and study and learn. That really is the key to being a good instructor in anything.
Excellent. I'm going to ask you one question that wasn't on my list I sent you, but it's come up recently online, and I just want you to share your opinion on it, and that is use of the slide-mounted red dot sight in Force on Force, which I think you've probably done more of that than anybody I know in terms of using it and getting an opinion on the use specifically for that. Where I looked at it from a live fire perspective, you've been looking at it from the tactics side, and I think you've got some interesting conclusions or certainly interesting observations that nobody else has really put out there yet.
Well, thank you. So, yeah, a little background on this. I actually came to Red Dots first on rifles in my military and government career. And at first, I was very skeptical. I'm like, no, I'm not going to bet my life on some piece of electronics. It requires batteries and so on and so forth. I deployed overseas. The people I was issued one. And the first place situation I found myself in, it really didn't feel like it was that great a threat. So I thought, oh, I bought my own quick-release mount and said, all right, I'll mount this thing on here and see how long it lasts. It's on a quick-release so I can ditch it in an instant if it fails on me. And then I'll be able to go back and tell everybody, see, I told you so. Those damn things, don't rely on them. Well, what I found after 3 years and the ability to track several hundred users in a global war on terror environment was that, man, they were very reliable. So reliability, the first question was answered. Second situation or second aspect is I found myself in several situations where I realized that there was a capability that I had exercised with the Red Dot that led to a successful conclusion that would have been more difficult with iron sights. And specifically, that is, when using iron sights to fire accurately, you've got to bring your vision back to that front sight, whether it's a rifle or a handgun. And when you bring your vision back to the front sight, you lose some degree of downrange awareness of what's going on. And a lot of people oversimplify this and they go, it doesn't matter. I've already decided to shoot that guy and all I need to see is my crystal clear front sight and my fuzzy bad guy and keep shooting him. And you're absolutely right in the simplest of situations. But now at a complex environment where that person is moving, maybe in front of and behind other people, some of whom need shot and some of whom don't need shot, where you're not sure if that guy actually needs shot or not. Yes, he has a gun, but is he not a bad guy? Could he be in the civilian setting? Could he be another armed citizen or an off-duty cop? People moving in and around and him moving so that he's going behind pieces of cover periodically or people that are cover periodically. And it's much easier to get effective hits when you can stay focused in the downrange area. And it's much easier to decide when it's time to shoot and when it's time to quit shooting when you can remain focused on the downrange area. I had one very poignant situation where one of my guys came out between me and the threat that I was engaging. And literally, their head appeared in my window of my EOTech. And I'm not that was a close thing as it was. And had that been shooting iron sights, I'm not sure how it would have worked out. So the bottom line is, and this is something that isn't really tested in competition. We don't really have the ability to do that. So then we fast forward and I said, you know, this was pretty dang powerful. I got older, got old man eyes, started having some vision issues with making the front sight clear. Realized that it didn't have that off the rifle with the Red Dot sight. Said, well, let's try this on handguns. Well, there's a bunch of challenges. The lack of multiple body index positions means you need greater proprioceptive index. You need more ability to bring the sights up and have them aligned, or there's no dot there. But there's things we deal with that. I don't want to say it's the answer to everything. There's a learning curve. I had a drop-in barrel system that simunition barrel that would go in my carry handgun. So I started using that carry handgun with a Red Dot sight on it in scenario training, both myself and making it available to students. And yeah, my initial impression from my time with a rifle overseas was, in my opinion, just strengthened and supported by that experience, seeing people and experiencing myself civilian type of settings and scenarios using the Red Dot sight.
That's excellent. It's, you know, you sort of piqued my interest in it, and that's one of my goals for this next year coming up is to get something set up so that I can have an RDS, you know, Red Dot type gun available for force-on-force training over the next year and let some students use it and see how it works for them. Just because I think that's an area that people aren't really exploring too much yet, and I think it's still worth investigating. I know my initial study results showed the learning curve side of it, but I've been looking more at the performance side of it, and certainly people that are skilled shooters are doing well and maybe shooting a little better with the Red Dot than they can with irons.
Mm-hmm.
And so I continue to look at it. My jury's still out, in my opinion, and
sure.
I think you're going in an interesting direction that's
yeah.
worthy of more study. Anything else you want to go ahead?
Well, just on the Red Dot site, there's I've been using one now in a handgun for nearly 6 years. I've tried different brands, tried different shaped dots. I've tried different size dots. That could be a whole other topic of discussion. I'd be happy to share with you my observations with that in another time if you'd like. We could talk about that for quite a while. But absolutely, I think it is without doubt, if you are a person that due to vision problems or having a hard time resolving your front sight, I guarantee you that with some practice, you'll find that you will shoot better dot sight at any time that you need or want to use the sights. And that's really it. You know, competition lets us test pure speed, but something I learned a long time ago in a study we did for law enforcement was that the law enforcement officers were testing proved to us that they could, in many cases, shoot faster than they could make good decisions. And shooting competition in terms of USPSA, IDPA, is certainly very, very valuable. I'm not discounting that at all. It's extremely valuable. But when we get up to the nuances of the very top level of performance, where we're talking about the speeds that are being achieved by master and grandmaster shooters like yourself, the fact of the matter is that is a great skill, but it is not likely to be the decisive factor in an actual encounter. And so we need to explore other areas in addition to the raw speed and accuracy.
Is there anything else you want to add about force-on-force training before we wrap up?
Well, I would just restate that, in my opinion, your goal should be to look for opportunities to exercise your skills in context in a environment that the skills have to be brought out as they are required. And, you know, if you're really trying to be prepared for self-defense encounters, to be well prepared, you've got to spend time on the interpersonal interaction aspect of it. And even more important, I would say, is you've got to spend time on the tactics portion of it. You know, again, a military analogy, you know, as a special forces soldier, if all we did was go to the range and shoot, well, that is certainly a valuable skill. But that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of actually managing situations and environment. One of the things that I point out to people is that in any environment, you don't actually win a gunfight by shooting the other guy, in my opinion. The definition of winning a gunfight is not getting shot. Now, guys have done a lot of, you know, hardcore mental conditioning stuff. I get it. You need to have a mindset that even if you're injured, you'll prevail. I get it. I'm there. But what I'm saying is all of your techniques, tactics, training, and equipment should be optimized to give the bad guy the minimum opportunity to shoot you. That is how you best right. prepare to win a gunfight. So if all you're practicing is how to shoot him and you're not looking at the aspect of how do I not get shot other than shoot him first, you're missing a big piece of it. And studying tactics first and then interactive scenario-based training second is, in my opinion, a critical piece of the puzzle.
So if people want to train with you or find out more about what you've got going on in terms of training, where can they go?
Right now, kind of in transition and a couple of things. Certainly look at insightstraining.com for classes there. I'm not doing a lot of traveling. I'm focusing on building out my business here in Washington. You can also look at westcoastarmorynorth.com. That's my range, and my training classes are listed there as well. And I am always, actually, if somebody wants to put together a class on the road, I still do that at times. So you can reach me at TBSH, Tango Bravo Sierra Hotel, at West Coast Armory North. Don't forget the North. There's another company out there, westcoastarmorynorth.com.
Outstanding. John, I really appreciate your time today. You've got a lot to offer. You've made some big contributions over the years to training, and I know that people listening to the podcast are really going to benefit from your wisdom today. So, again, thanks again for sharing that with
us. Thanks for having me on, Carl. I appreciate it. It's always great to talk with you and even better to train with you. I look forward to the next opportunity.
Well, that wraps it up for me today on the Handgun World Podcast. My name's Carl Wren with KR Training. If you want to find out more about me and my training, it's krtraining.com, blog.krtraining.com, or check us out on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.